good evening, and welcome to another Bird Calls from the Knoll Foundation Studios here on Red River Radio. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. We invite you to call in with your questions tonight about our feathered friends and the avian world during the show at 800-552-8502. You can also make a pledge for Bird Calls tonight at that same number, 800-552-8502, or you could go online to redriverradio.org, make a pledge, and in the comments section, if you have a question you'd like to have Cliff answer, go ahead and put that in the comments section. That's very easy to do tonight. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he is ready to answer your questions about birds. He is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he's held since 1997, and he's been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is also the first author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M University Press, and he has authored over 60 publications on birds and birding. He and his wife, Julie, and their two children live in East Texas. And Cliff, welcome back to Bird Calls.
Great. Thank you, Bill. I'm always happy to be here. I enjoy this.
If you have a question, once again, we encourage you to call in right now at 800-552-8502. We'll try to get as many questions in tonight, and we hope to also get some support for Bird Calls tonight as well. So please go ahead, make that phone call, make a pledge, help us out, and we'll try to answer your questions. And first up, we have been doing what we call kind of like a special spotlight on a bird each month, and we're going to open up right away with this bird, and Cliff is going to tell us all about it.
Something you'll hear in your backyard. Listen again.
And then it changes pitch there.
He changes a little bit, and that's to give an example of variation. But the pattern is pretty similar, and it's a two-part song, and it sounds like he's saying, cheer, cheer, birdie, 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 birdie. So the first part is the cheer, cheer, and the second part of the song is the birdie, birdie. This is the northern cardinal, what a lot of people just say, call redbird. The colloquial name. The colloquial name is like the old timer's name or the farmer name, but the correct ornithological name is northern cardinal. And that's a bird that you might hear in your backyard and you're wondering, what is that? And it's hard to believe that something so bright red can hide. And they do often sing in a conspicuous spot, but a lot of times they'll sit and hide when they call. And what's really interesting, I think, it's one of the very few examples of a songbird that the females also sing. So in the songbird order of birds, the females tend not to sing. They'll make call notes, chip notes, things like that, but the true song, most your songbirds don't do it if they're a female, but the cardinal is one of the exceptions. Some of the orioles are also in the exception category, but I think cardinal's neat because it also the female will be singing. So you'll have those year-round in your backyard. I think most people are familiar with them. The males look very different from the females, and they're just a great bird to have singing in your backyard. And that's, again, northern cardinal. And we put the modifier northern because there are other species of cardinals on the planet, not in the listening area. There's only one species here in the U.S. But if you go farther south, you start picking up other species of cardinals. So you have to apply a modifier just like we do with people's names. So that's Smith. Well, is that John Smith or Bob Smith?
Right. Now, are these are migratory, are they not?
They're not. They're resident. They're resident species. They don't make long-distance migrations. They might make a little short-distance migration. They get into big groups in the wintertime. People love it in the colder months because you can see a bush with 10 or 12 or more male cardinals together. They're just very tolerant in the wintertime. But, boy, when it comes breeding season, they separate. Those males make their own territories, and they defend it, and they have their mate, and they defend that territory. And that's when you don't see 10 or 12 cardinals at a time is in the breeding season. So, like right now, if you do see two males together, usually arguing over a territorial line, some kind of an imaginary line that they've picked that they're battling over.
So it's sort of like, now the Cardinals that I grew up with in Ohio, then they didn't come down south, but the Robins would migrate out of the winter months.
Right. So the Robins, highly migratory. Lots of birds are, but there are quite a few that are not migratory, and the Cardinal's one of those that he's probably born really close to where you see him, very close, like within miles.
All right. You are listening to Bird Calls, a special edition tonight on Red River Radio. It is our fun drive at the end of the year drive, and we're trying to not only raise a little money for the station so that we can do more of these kinds of shows, but also raise some awareness about our ornithological world and hopefully increase the appreciation for the beauty that birds add to our lives. And you can call us up right now at 800-552-8502, or you can go online right now to redriverradio.org and get your question into Cliff Shackelford. He is the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, and he's also our resident ornithologist and our host for Bird Calls. So we've got a couple of other bird sounds that we're going to get to you, but first we do have a caller who called in with a question, and what they wanted to know was what to do with those house sparrows that are getting into the bluebird and martin houses.
Yeah, the folks that really want to be good landlords of purple martin houses and bluebird houses have to really watch out for other species that are looking for the same free government housing, and that's the house sparrow. So the house sparrow is not native to the U.S., so it's not protected by state or federal law. So you can, as the landlord, go, and what's recommended is go in while they're in the building phase and rip out the nest. You can tell a house sparrow nest from those others because they just load it with a lot of wispy grasses, and it's just a bundled mess and very packed, and you just get in there and keep ripping it out until the house sparrows figure it out. But if you want to have bluebirds or purple martins, you've got to be vigilant about it.
Now, back in, I think it was March, I think it was before or maybe right after the March show that we did, I had sent you a bird sound. This was actually a recording that I made in the master bathroom, the bathroom off the master bedroom. And it, for me, it sounded as if the bird was inside the venting up there. And it, well, we'll fill you in on the clue later on, but this was actually recorded in my master bathroom, and it was quite noticeable for quite some time.
Yeah, those are European starlings. You can hear a lot of that pts, 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 little high frequency calls and clucks and chucks. It's variable. And this is another non-native. We mentioned the house sparrow a minute ago. Well, this is another one that was brought in from Europe. And they've done very well. They like cavities, like old woodpecker holes, but they also will look at pipes as being a cavity. So if you have a horizontal pipe going in and out of the house, they'll use that. You'll see them up on light posts where the at the intersection where it's red, yellow, green, you'll see them go in the end of those pipes. Mm. It's the same thing. It's very protected. It's very much like a cavity, and very protected. It's hard for a predator to get there. So, but depending on what you're, if that's just an air vent, that's easy. But what you want to do is probably make sure you cap all those kinds of vent holes because they're stuffing it with flammable material. So what most houses and apartments do is cap those with a screen to keep critters out. And this is one of those critters that would go in there.
Right. So well, give us a call right now if you'd like to get your question in on Bird Calls tonight, 800-552-8502. You can also make a pledge when you call in, but it's not required. We would like it personally, but it's not required. And you could also go online right now to redriverradio.org and make a pledge there. And in the comments section, go ahead and send in your question as well. We've got Clint Cliff for a full 2 hours tonight. I'm already brain dead halfway into this drive. Cliff is with us for a full 2 hours tonight, so we need to fill up that time with your questions and your phone calls, and we'd love to hear from you. 800-552-8502, or go online now to redriverradio.org. redriverradio.org. And so you were saying that those starlings like to nest, correct?
Oh, yeah. They like to nest close to humans, out and away from homes. They'll actually kick out woodpeckers. Their problem in certain parts of the country, they'll just sit there and wait and wait until the woodpecker has finished the cavity, and then they'll kick that woodpecker out. They're super aggressive, and they're not built to make the cavity, so they kind of have to let the woodpecker do his thing because the starling can't do all the excavating like the woodpecker can. So they're just super aggressive, and they just take over, and it's a problem in parts of the country. Like for the red-headed woodpecker, the starling will usurp that red-headed from his own cavity. Mm-hmm. So where it's okay is when it's an old, outdated woodpecker cavity that either the woodpeckers finished using or used it the year before, then a starling can move in. But it is a problem when it's a freshly made cavity that the woodpecker spent a couple weeks excavating, and here comes the bully and moves in on its home that it's created.
So of course, I got these up in my roof, and what you would expect happened did happen. This young couple decided they were going to start a family in my roof, and so sometime later, guess what I was hearing? This is actually coming through the ceiling of my downstairs living room. So this is above the ceiling, cutting through the plaster.
Yep. And those are nestling starlings. They're saying, feed me, mommy, daddy, feed me, mommy, mommy, mommy. I think we, as parents, some of us know what that sounds like. It's incessant. So they'll be doing that for weeks until they finally fledge, or at least days until they fledge, because as they get larger, their voice gets louder. But when they're a few days old, you're probably not going to hear it. But that's the sound of begging baby starlings. I don't even need to see it. I just know by the voice that that's what they're doing. So those are babies. They're saying, feed me, I'm hungry. Mama, mama.
Yes, and they do that very early in the morning, in case you ever get these in your... I would be awoken right at about 5 a.m. on a lovely Saturday, not the time that I want to wake up on a Saturday.
So it's probably amplified, too, in that pipe.
Right,
It has an echo effect, so it's probably very loud. So, you might want to put a hardware cloth over that end of that after this breeding season. Let them finish this year. Try to get some wire in there, pull out all the nest material, and then put hardware cloth or some other cover to keep them out. It's a good idea.
Well, if you've got a bird question, anything having to do with our avian world, give us a call, 800-552-8502. Or you can go online right now to redriverradio.org. Of course, we're also trying to make some money around the program tonight to support Red River Radio. So if you are inclined, please do make a pledge as well. But by all means, give us your questions as well. Again, 800-552-8502. Or online right now to redriverradio.org. We have one more, we have a whole slew of different bird sounds that we could play tonight, because I've been collecting up a number of them that I'm curious about. But this one actually came in from a listener, and it came in just the other day. This recording was taken in the evening around dusk at South Llano River State Park in Junction, Texas, and they kind of wanted to know what this was.
That's a great song, and that really reminds me of living in the hill country. It's a song you hear in where you've got a lot of limestone bluffs and creek bottoms and cliff faces. That is the canyon wren, and that's a bird you have to drive. In this listening area, you'd have to drive to Austin to start hearing. I lived there for a good while, and I would see them about as far east as I'd see or hear canyon wren would be like the Barton Creek Mall area, which is roughly Mopac and 360, and they're in the green belt there, the Barton Creek green belt. So they like the bluffs, and the neat thing is they have kind of a stair step downward song, like it's going choo 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 choo, like he's running down the steps. And that's again the canyon wren, and they're a neat little bird. They're a large wren. They like those cliff faces and rock faces and bluffs. What's interesting is when they're homes, they'll use the side of your house. They'll even go down in your chimney. So there are a lot of accounts of them getting in the house, if you don't have your chimney capped, of them getting in the house and probably not find their way out, but making a mess, pooing everywhere until you can open the door till they fly out. So they're very curious like wrens are, and they're a big, large wren, and they're really cool, and I love that song. So I'm really glad someone captured that. And you can do that now, which what's amazing, on your smartphone. I'll be out in the woods, and I won't have my fancy recording equipment, and I'll hear something, and I just switch my camera function over to video and not worry about capturing a sight, but the sound it picks up. And I've really gathered a few neat sounds that way that I wouldn't have had the opportunity because I didn't have my equipment with me.
So really, if you're out and about and you've got your smartphone with you, you've got a portable recording device right there.
That's
most
right.
of them have like a memo function or something like that. And all you need really is 30 or 40 seconds at the most of a bird call, you know, relatively decent quality, but we can enhance it and then Cliff can go ahead and answer the question.
Yeah, that's right. It works really well with frog calls too, because at night when frogs and toads are calling, you don't see them. They're very difficult to hear. You get close and guess what they do? They stop calling. So the frog experts can identify the frogs and toads by their voice too. Same principle as what bird people do.
Yeah. Well, give us a call, 800-552-8502. You are listening to Bird Calls, and Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist and also a statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. And we'd love to have your questions tonight. If you can call in, make a pledge, by all means. I am not going to stop you from doing that because that's how we fund public radio. But by all means, just go ahead and give us your question too. You know, we'll slip it in, but I'm going to needle you a little bit. I want you to make a pledge because that's how we're going to continue to do this kind of stuff. So now we do have a couple of calls or questions coming in. And one of those was the caller wanted to know what birds mate for life.
Well, that's pretty unusual. I know a lot of people would like to think that it's more common than it is, but mating for life is very unusual. So there are a few species, you know, whooping cranes are a fairly good example. Although there are accounts of them switching mates, but for the most part, birds are monogamous within a breeding season, but not the next year or the next year. So a lot of birds do pair up within a breeding season. Like right now, they'll be paired up, but that doesn't mean they'll be paired up the next year. There are exceptions. There are some birds that are polygamous, like the red-winged blackbird, and the male will have a little harem of several females. The great-tailed grackle is another one like that. So there are exceptions to that, but for the most part, birds are monogamous, but only within a breeding season. They're not monogamous for life. And so it's a romantic notion, but heck, look at humans. We're not much better at pairing for life, are we?
Well, I have a curious question. Is part of that because that helps diversify the gene pool and therefore over the entire species perhaps creates a stronger brood for the next year?
Well, in most cases, having the pair mate for life ensures that there's two parents helping to feed. That's right. Really important. And also when the young birds fledge, they're typically not ready to do full flight. They kind of just hop from limb to limb, and they can kind of take the young of, say, four in the nest, and, you know, mom, you take a couple, and dad, you take a couple, and split off, and that thus greatening your chances of raising at least one to adulthood. Not every bird is going to make it to adulthood. So it just helps in getting your chances up there for getting those birds to adulthood, because that's the name of the game. And biological success is measured by replacing yourself and perpetuating your species. And so having mom and dad there allows for more mouths to help feed, and also to defend when there's a potential predator, you know, a raptor or a cat or a snake. You've got more adults to help protect the nest.
All right. Yep. You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. He is also the non-game ornithologist for the Texas Park and Wildlife Departments. I should always look at my copy before I try to say it. And he's also the author, by the way, of a book called Hummingbirds of Texas. And we have copies of that as a thank you gift tonight. So if you would really like a cool book, call in during the show, make a pledge, give us your question, and ask for the Hummingbirds of Texas. It's available at the $120 a year level, and it's a great read. I've already got my copy. It's already the binder's kind of getting busted up because I go out now and I'm looking for some of the different hummingbirds around the area, you know, and having some fun.
Well, and I'm biased, of course. I think it's a great book, and I mentioned this on the fun drive, is that all the royalties from the sale of that book go back to Texas Parks and Wildlife's Hummingbird Roundup program, where we encourage backyard enthusiasts to collect scientific data, or what we call citizen science data, on what the hummingbirds are doing in their yard, what species of plant they're feeding on, how often they come to the feeder, what's the first arrival date of your ruby throat or black chin, did you have a wintering rufous hummingbird, when did they nest, things like that is what the Hummingbird Roundup's all about. So I'm pretty proud that the money goes back to hummingbirds. And then when you make your pledge here, your money, of course, also goes to supporting Red River Radio.
And getting shows like this and other things on the air. You know, we've got a special Health Matters coming up on Thursday. We'd like to increase these productions. We want more local focus in what we do, but that takes, you know, resources and things like that. So guess what? We need you all. We need you to go ahead and make a pledge tonight and get your question in, 800-552-8502, or you can go online right now to redriverradio.org. When you make your pledge in the comments section, you can pass on a question as well. Our next caller wants to know, they had a hummingbird in late March, a male, they suspect, and it has left, and they want to know if it would indeed come back.
It was what was the species?
It was a hummingbird.
A hummingbird. Yeah, in the South, we get a lot of hummingbirds pouring through here, and people hope that they stay, and a lot of them don't. So, like ruby throats, they're going all the way up to the Great Lakes state, so it's hard to know if that bird's going to come back the next year or if it's going to stick around and breed. Now, we were talking about monogamy, and I didn't mention that hummingbirds, if you like hummingbirds, get this. They are some deadbeat dads. So after he copulates with the female, he's done. She is a single mom for the rest of the nesting season. She builds the nest, she incubates, she feeds the young. He doesn't do anything except look for other girlfriends to have. And so he's just never been involved in the care of young and never will. It's just the way they are. But, you know, in the human world, we call that a deadbeat dad. But he's got himself a little harem. And they do, ruby throats do nest in the listening area here. If you go much farther west, you can pick up black chins. You got to get to about I-35 in central Texas before you start picking up black chin hummingbirds. But they're east of I-35, those are going to be ruby-throated. And so here in Louisiana as well, for the nesting season, those are going to be ruby-throated hummingbirds. And so they do stay in small numbers, and you have to be quick about it to see them. And more than a feeder, a lot of people say, I put a feeder up and I didn't get any hummingbirds. Well, there's more to it. You want to also plant native plants that are nectar giving. So you want to plant what we call a wildscape, and those are nectar giving and berry giving plants that are good for wildlife. And so it's good for hummingbirds and butterflies to put out some nectar giving plants, things like native lantana, Turk's cap, all kinds of salvia. These are really beautiful plants that also have some value. So if you're putting out, you know, something showy like a bougainvillea, there is no nectar value with that. So it might look pretty, but you can get pretty out of the native stuff that's also giving back. So why not focus your effort on the double whammy, where it looks good and also has value, and a triple whammy, it's acclimated to the local environment, to the soils and the weather. and the wet and dry cycles. So you want to make sure you're not putting tropical stuff in. You know, a lot of people like tropicals, but what do you do when there's that April cold front? You got to bring them in. Well, the natives, you don't have to mess around with, and they do better with our rain or lack thereof if we're in a drought. And they certainly do better with the soil. So if you go to Central Texas and you like the bluebonnets, well, that's a very different soil than over here. There is a different species of bluebonnet here, but if you like that Texas bluebonnet, they need to be in that blackland soil, and we just don't have it. So the salinity, or the pH is just very different. So that's another thing to think about, is make sure you're picking those species that do well with the local soil, the local environment. So that wildscape is really going to help bring in a lot more hummingbirds and encourage them to stay. It's not just the feeder.
Right. So things like vincas and impatient, and you're not going to really... they might bring butterflies in, but they're not going to do a lot for...
They usually bring things in, and then they're looking and they're looking, and they're like, this cupboard is empty. Mm-hmm. So instead, bring them in with the color, because the color is what attracts them. That's the neon sign that says, come over here. So what you want to do is have those plants that are nectar giving to encourage them to come and stay. And also, you get some small insects like gnats, and that's really important for hummingbirds as well. So only about 85 to 90% of their diet is that sweet nectar. The other 10 or 15% is in the form of protein, so they need to do a lot of insect catching and insect eating. So the wildscape also provides them with tiny little gnats that they need for protein. They can't live on just the nectar alone.
Yeah, so refresh our memories. When would be the best time, if you were going to do a bird, you know, hummingbird feeder and that, to actually see and get the hummingbirds? Would that be like the late fall, winter time, or early spring, but maybe not the dead of summer?
No, we recommend putting the feeders out year-round here in the South, because you'll get the numbers really peak in September. The last half of September here in the listening area is when ruby throats are just pouring through and stacking up and refueling. They're using our backyard feeders kind of like a gas station along the way to refuel. So you see your biggest numbers in September. So what if you're trying to encourage that year round, it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
Because what you're seeing are all those birds leaving the country. So some of those birds might have been 2 weeks earlier in Michigan or Minnesota or Wisconsin, and they're coming through, and your yard is just happens to be along their path to go to the tropics to overwinter. They're just there, again, like the gas station on a long right. journey. So, but in the wintertime, if you leave your feeder up, you're not going to stop a hummingbird from migrating. That's hardwired. That's a silly old wives' tale that says you got to take your feeder down or the hummingbirds won't migrate. Well, that's silly. Hummingbirds are hardwired to do it. Instead, you're going to probably find out that there are some more western hummingbirds that come over here in our mild winters and stay for the winter months. And if we didn't have those feeders up, that could be bad on things like rufous and broad-tailed hummingbirds that come over here and overwinter with us. So in the springtime, we see our first ruby throat show up usually around mid-March. So if you don't like to keep your feeder up in the winter, you can probably start putting up in the 1st of March, and you'll probably get rewarded sometime on a March date. And then those birds will migrate through, and you might not have a breeding pair in your neighborhood, so, or in your backyard, so you might not see any activity in June, July, August, but guess what? Here comes September again, and there are those northern birds coming through. So it's really a year-round thing, and that's the beauty of all this, is you start to uncover this whole big, beautiful world out there, and you start seeing patterns, and that's what makes a lot of this fun, is learn as you go and try to figure out these patterns yourself.
Well, give us a call right now. You're listening to Bird Calls, and you can call in with your question at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. You can also make a pledge there, or you can go online right now, and we are using our pledge forms as a way of getting a question in as well, go online to redriverradio.org, make a pledge, and in the comments section, go ahead and pass off a question. And I'm going to ask Cliff to go ahead and hand that pledge over here, and we're going to just send a thank you out because somebody did call in, an anonymous pledge from Shreveport. We thank you very much, and we appreciate your support and hope that others will join you tonight as we try to get two birds, literally, with one stone. Let's make some pledging and also do a full extended version of bird calls tonight with Cliff Shackelford. He is the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Park and Wildlife Department and our resident ornithologist. We have another called-in question here, and this person, they're in South Arkansas, and they identified a house wren and song sparrow using an Audubon Society field guide. They want to know if these birds are possible for that area.
If the date was May, I would say definitely not on the song sparrow. I bet it was another member of the same genus, a similar looking bird called the Lincoln sparrow. And they are still trickling through in May, house wrens as well. If you get a little farther north, you might be able to start picking up house wrens breeding. They might even have house wrens there in southern Arkansas, but probably not. Those could be still stragglers that are heading north, but I'm guessing that was not a song sparrow. Because song sparrows, they tend to get out of Dodge pretty early for our winter birds. They really are gone in huge numbers by April 1st. They're really tough to see in April and super, super tough to see in May. So I'm guessing Lincoln sparrow because I still see Lincoln sparrows right now, or at least up to a week ago, and they look very song sparrow-ish.
And they are migratory as well, but they just move through a little later
right.
in the season.
They don't nest in the listening area, the Lincoln sparrow. But the house sparrow, we would be picking up the southern extent of their range. In the Wachitas probably, and I'm not terribly sure where their southern limit is. I just know that in the listening area of Texas, Louisiana, we do not have house wrens nesting. What we do have are Carolina wrens, and yeah, they're near the house, but that's not how you identify birds. Let's see, it's a wren, and there's my house. It must be a house wren. Nope, that's not how it works. So Carolina wren looks very different. Has a big white eyebrow, real buffy undersides, and we hear them a lot. It sounds like this, dooley, 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 dooley. Very different. House wren, I can't even imitate. It's just an incredible, complex song. But the Carolina wren will nest around our house. That if you have a old coffee can or a boot on its side, they'll nest in that. If you leave the garage door open, there's so many nooks and crannies that they'll nest in, and that is a Carolina wren nesting in this listening area. It's not a house wren.
Okay. You're listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. He's also the statewide ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. He's going to take your calls tonight for another hour and a half or so at 800-552-8502. If you have a question about anything dealing with birds, give us a call and we'll get your question in. And also, if you'd like to make a pledge tonight, feel free to do so. 800-552-8502 or online at redriverradio.org. Now, once again, I went out into my backyard and just let my recorder roll for about 8 minutes. And what I hear, I've got four different excerpts here. What I hear is different types of birds, but I may be wrong because I'm not a statewide non-game ornithologist expert, but let's take a listen to this sample and see what it is.
Yeah, there are a lot of things calling in there. I even heard someone coughing.
Yeah, coughing. Yeah, well, that's right outside of an apartment. It's definitely a neighborhood.
Yeah, and actually, I just mentioned the Carolina wren and I imitated the dooley, 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 and I could hear that.
That
one was in the middle towards the end, and at the very end, I heard a cardinal, which is the one we featured.
Right.
And then the beginning, the first thing I heard was a house sparrow making the chirping note. So, yeah, I mean, that's pretty neat. You picked up three birds right there outside. outside your, was that your front door area?
That was right outside. I've got a little patio area, and then there's a little, you know, manicured area, yeah. little flowers and some mondo grass and stuff. And I just set my recorder down there, closed the door, went inside for about, I don't know, 15 minutes, came back, and then listened and took out the excerpts that I thought were appropriate for yep. the show tonight. So you're invited to call in right now. We just had a call not too long ago. If you'd like to make a question and go on the air, we can get you on the air as well. Just give us a call at 800-552-8502. Or you can go online tonight at redriverradio.org, make a pledge, and in the comments section there, go ahead and send in your question for Cliff to answer as well. We're going to go to some photos, and two of these are on our website right now. The other two are probably copywritten, so I stole them from the website to identify those birds that I was dealing with. But the first one was sent in. And that was from Roy Blake, and he said, these pictures were taken on April 14th. I think it's a Cooper's hawk, but then I read where it is difficult to differentiate from the sharp-spined hawk. Sorry for the poor quality of the cell phone camera, and he had a pair of binoculars for lenses, so the quality is not necessarily that good, but you've gone ahead and identified this again.
Yeah, there are two lookalikes, the Cooper's hawk, and the other one's called the sharp-shinned, S-H-I-N-N-E-D, like a soccer player kicking your shin. So this is a Cooper's hawk. This person nailed it, which is really good. And collectively, those two birds are called accipiters. That's the genus. And also, the colloquial name for the two is blue darter. And a lot of old-timers talk about, yeah, I saw a blue darter come in and take a bird. Well, that's how they feed. They don't eat, they eat birds on that they catch on the wing. So that's just what they do. So this is a bird that's on top of something and looks like it's tearing it up. We can't really see that, but this is a Cooper's hawk. It shows the cap on the head. It's a darker gray than the rest of the face, and it's separated on from the back. So that tells me it's a Cooper's hawk. Because by itself, you can't really tell if it's large or small, because Cooper's hawk is much larger. Well, they're supposed to be larger. The female Cooper's hawk is certainly larger than the male sharp-shinned hawk. So the males are smaller in most of your raptors. Not all of your raptors, but in this species or this genus, Accipiter, the males are smaller. And so a sharp-shinned male is going to feed on different stuff than the much larger female Coopers, just because their size difference is so much that she's going to eat bigger prey than he is. And that's good. That allows them to not compete among the differences there in the among the two between the species. So this is a Cooper's hawk, so this one will be online. So people
that is actually online right now. So if folks go to redriverradio.org and click on the bird calls post there, it's kind of in the center column, about one or two down. They'll open it up and they'll see this photo and the very next one. And the next one was sent in by a local photographer, Neil Johnson. He had seen this around the corner from his house in South Highlands, and he said it's about 3 to 4 feet wide, more than 100 feet up, not near any water. Appears to be a nest of a large bird, heron or hawk. He wasn't sure, but he wanted to know whether, in fact, that's what it was.
Yeah, and this is a neat picture. Let me describe it for those that can't see it online, and you can go later to look at it. It's in a pine tree. It's up high. It very much looks like a nest because you can't see sky through it. You can see sky through all the neighboring limbs, but all of a sudden there's this dark blob. But if you look carefully, though, the blob is not sticks and leaves. It's green needles, and this is actually not a bird nest. This is what in forester terms is called a witch's broom. A silviculturist would call this a witch's broom, and it's not made by a bird. Instead, it's usually an injury to a tree limb, and there's a fungus involved, and this is the growth. This creates this weird accelerated fuzzy growth of that limb, and I've seen it. You don't see it every day. And they're different sizes and shapes, but the thing they have in common, they're made of green needles, and they're just thick and matted. You can't see sky through them. but it's the tree growing that way, and it's not done by any kind of animal. It looks like it'd be a great place for a nest. Yeah. And actually, there is a paper I've read, because it was my former supervisor. Dick Connor wrote a paper about a great horned owl using it, but as a roost site. And I never saw pictures of it, and I don't remember the details. But I think that the great horned owl was roosting in there as protection, because it's great. It's dark under there. You wouldn't get rained on. You wouldn't get sun. And more importantly for an owl, you wouldn't get harassed by all the other songbirds, because I think most listeners probably have seen songbirds. They get really wild and crazy, and they do what's called mobbing of predators, and owls get mobbed a lot. It's kind of like a neighborhood watch program where all the songbirds get together and try to oust the owl. Well, a lot of people say, well, how are they so bold and getting right there in front of the owl? And sometimes the blue jays and mockingbirds will even hit the owl. Well, the element of surprise is gone, and that's how owls and most predators feed. Mm-hmm. They sneak up on you. Well, if he's front and center, everybody's looking at you and screaming at you, your element of surprise is done. It's gone. It's over. So that usually upsets the owl. They can't take the harassment, and they fly off and try to sleep. This happens in the daytime, of course, and they try to find another quiet spot to sleep. So I imagine this witch's broom was a great place for an owl to roost, because he's very sheltered.
Ah, yes.
Yeah.
Well, you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. He's also the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. And he joins us a couple of times, once about every couple of months, for a program about birds and our avian world. We invite you to call in at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. If you have a question about anything to do with the birds, you can also go online. We're also asking people to make pledges tonight, just so you know. It's a fun drive version of this. And if you go online and want to make a pledge, go ahead and in the comments section of that pledge form, go ahead and send in your question as well, and we'd be happy to send that on to Cliff. And we do have another caller who had called in. They wanted to know, they have a small gray bird that flies like a hummingbird and has a tuft of hair on the top of its head. They want to know what kind of bird that is.
Well, there are not many birds with tufts of hair. They're actually going to be feathers. Remember, mammals have fur,
right,
or hair, and birds have feathers. They're derived from the same thing, keratin, but that's going to be probably a crest of a tufted titmouse. And I wouldn't say they fly like a hummingbird. Nothing flies like a hummingbird except a hummingbird, except maybe a few insects might. But that description probably fits with tufted titmouse, because they're gray, they're in backyards, and they have that tuft or crest on the top of the head. And they're the ones that makes the peter, 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 or what we call the peter, peter call, or the hear, hear. And they're incessant right now. And I have to be honest, it's one of my least favorite calls, because when I'm out doing point counts, which is what bird people do to get a census, they have to stop and stand and listen for a few minutes and count everything they see and hear. Well, if you have a tufted titmouse camped above you and he's calling, he's really drowning out everything else. It's kind of like having somebody pull up with their car radio going, and you're trying to hear things over the radio. Well, the titmouse can be, in my opinion, a little bit incessant and overbearing, but it's a great bird. Don't get me wrong. I love titmice. I just don't like them in high gear singing when I'm trying to do a point count, because I want to hear everything else in there. Right. They're so loud. What's amazing is that's a little bitty guy making so much noise out of that little frame. But they'll come to your backyard feeder. They really like to eat sunflower seeds, and they're really cool to watch because they don't crack the seed open like a cardinal does, like a vice grip. They have to pin that seed down with a foot, and then they pry and peck at it while holding it. So it's pretty neat that they're holding it and trying to open it at the same time, which is pretty cool.
And this is an example. You had gotten me this sound effect a few months ago, so let's go on.
Yep. Peter, Peter, Peter. Yeah, that's the call that we'll hear in this listening area all the time in the breeding season. Right now, they're in my backyard, just over and over and over. And that's a male. That's what birds do. The males are telling other males that this is my home, keep out. So we put up fences, and birds use bird calls, songs rather, to say this is occupied or there's no vacancy, keep out. So
now when a bird goes into like a warning chirp versus a hey sweetie I'm over here kind of chirp, is it distinguishable and obvious to kind of the lay ear that they've gone in from mating mode to warning mode?
Right, and that's a good example. That let's use the titmouse. We heard the Peter, 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 or the so that's a song. When he sees that owl that we talked about a minute ago, he's going to make a raspy call, and that is a different context. That's when he's really upset, and it's very different context that he's doing that. So that's a more of an annoyed scold is what he's doing.
Give us a call right now at 800-552-8502 if you'd like to get your question in to Cliff Shackelford. He is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio and our guest expert on bird calls. He's also the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. And we'd like to get your calls, 800-552-8502, or you can go online to redriverradio.org and make a pledge. And by golly, we do have a couple of online pledges. We want to thank these folks right now. Rick Wall, thank you very much from Rick Wall, who is a good friend. He likes everything. He's headed home from El Dorado and wanted to support Red River Radio. Thank you very much, Rick. We appreciate it. And also, he's a guy standing right behind Cliff here. He is our membership manager, Henry Edwards, and he made his pledge tonight around bird calls. So we thank you, Henry. And he's like, yeah. So give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. Oh, he's trying to point out something here. I see a lot of squiggles on the bottom. The pledge is in honor of McWayne the cat, who will soon be scarfing down food with a scoop bowl from Red River Radio. Yeah, right. Okay. I saw the quote marks on there. The punctuation doesn't translate well on our pledge form, unfortunately. Well, we hope you'll give us a call right now. And we do have a caller who we're getting sent messages from our pledge room. That's how we're taking the calls tonight. And this one says, the caller has a bird feeder and they can identify most of the birds feeding at it. However, there is a bird that looks like a sparrow but has a bright red head. Wants to know what kind of bird that is.
Yeah, and that's kind of a new or recent addition to the area over the last 25-ish years. That's a house finch. The female has no red, very streaked, very sparrow-looking, but the male is similar, although he's got this bright purpley-red head with some bleeding down the chest, and a lot of people think they're purple finches, and we do have purple finches in the colder months, but right now if you've got one at your feeder, that's a house finch, and they weren't here 30 years ago. They're a fairly recent addition, and they're nice. They have a beautiful song. I kind of like them, and they'll put their nest in a hanging basket on the back porch, very safe and secure. You know, not many predators can get up in there, and they feel a little cozy next to the house where they're protected from predators and the elements. You know, it's good to stay out of the hot sun and the pouring rain. So under the porch is a great place to do it.
You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist and bird expert, Cliff Shackelford. And we're taking your calls tonight. And also your pledges tonight, you can call in at 800-552-8502 and get a question into Cliff. Or you can go online at redriverradio.org. And if you'd like to make a pledge there, you can. And then in the comments section, you can go ahead and get your question in that way. And we'll pass it on to Cliff. Cliff is also also the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. And we have a caller, first one tonight. Of course, we've been trying to get everybody to pledge tonight, so I haven't really given you a chance, folks, have I? Go ahead and make your pledge, but we're going to take a caller right now from Longview. Hello, you're on the air with Cliff. Hello, you're on the air with Cliff. Hello?
Mr. Shackelford?
Yep. Yes.
Yeah, I'm calling because I have immediately behind my house a very dense forest. I woke up recently and I could hear a bird that I had never heard before. Three short whistles, all at the same level, and then the bird whistled in such a way as to make what was almost perfect statement of pleasure, pleasure, pleasure.
Huh.
So I have no idea what he could have been, and I'm sure you don't either, probably.
Well, you know, and converting a bird sound to words is really tough.
Yeah,
and,
it is.
And so what you hear might be different from what I hear. I could take some guesses, but I don't know what that is. Tell me more. Do you see the bird, maybe?
No, it was 3 o'clock in the morning, and I was just lying in bed, and I woke up and heard his call. And was intrigued by it, and I knew you were coming on, and I thought, well, I'll take this opportunity to speak with you about it. But I apologize for not being able to give you a more accurate description.
Well, you just said something important. You said 3 a.m., is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, well, there's not a whole lot going on at 3 a.m., right?
No.
I mean, other than
not
your...
Not here, at any rate.
And what are you doing awake at that hour? Well, there are not a whole lot of birds calling at that hour, and there are some non-birds calling at that hour. I mentioned that on one of the shows, and I got a lot of positive feedback from people that have been hearing what's called a Rio Grande chirping frog, and it makes a chirp, 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 chirp. That doesn't sound like what you saw, but if we're pretty certain it was a bird, at 3 a.m., there are just not a lot of choices. You've got Chuckwill's widow, maybe a common nighthawk. Maybe you're hearing the distant part of the Chuckwill's widow, and all that's coming through is the end of it. I don't know, but just because you had it at 3 a.m. really narrows the field down a lot.
Yeah, well... I suppose that maybe I was not fully awake when I heard it, but very definitely he made the call two or possibly three times, I don't remember exactly, and it always ended with a call that sounded like pleasure, pleasure.
Huh. Yeah, I would encourage you to, we talked about that earlier, using your smartphone, switching your photo option over to video and just record it. If it's loud enough for you to hear it, your smartphone's probably going to pick it up, and then maybe you can play it the next time.
Well, the next time you're on, I'll call you.
Yeah, great. Hey, awesome. And try to get some sleep between now and then.
Maybe that's what I really need anyway. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank
I
you.
Appreciate it.
I kind of wish I had brought my sound effect of the Chuckwill Widow that I'd recorded years ago. I could have played that for him, so... Give us a call right now at 800-552-8502 if you have a question for Cliff Shackelford, who is our resident non-game ornithologist and our bird expert here on Red River Radio. He's also with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. And we do have a question that came in with a phone call. The caller wants to know what happened to all the bobwhite quail.
Well, that's a good question. We could spend an hour on that one. It's pretty depressing, though. There's no happy ending to this story, but the bobwhite has many things going against it. It doesn't like fragmentation. It doesn't like non-native grasses. It doesn't really like humans. You know, where you see bobwhite doing well, they're in areas where the land ownership is large. It's not fragmented and chewed up and beaten up into little small pieces. there's still native grass, and there are not big cities nearby. So in Texas, the two last big strongholds are South Texas, the Kingsville area in south and west of, and the rolling plains, like think of the Wichita Falls, Abilene area, and up the eastern part of the panhandle of Texas. And those are really the strongholds. But if you start on the Atlantic coast and move westward, through Florida, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, the bobwhite has just almost completely disappeared. There are pockets, and it is a little confusing that some people have what we call put and take hunting operations where you can release bobwhite and hunt them, but they're not wild. They're not native born. And those cage birds that come out of the cage, they don't last long at all. I'm talking about even if they get past the hunter, they've got a lifespan of probably a week or two, just because they don't know about the problems of being out in the wild with predators and weather and so forth. So, but the big killer, in my opinion, is the non-native grass. We have, people see grasslands, they say, oh, there's plenty of grass. Well, it's the species of grass that's the problem. We have replaced our native grasses with cool season grasses from the old world, European species, African species, you name it. We have moved other species from other grasses from other continents here, and it creates a different environment. It's more of a carpet grass and doesn't allow bobwhite anywhere to go. They like bunch grasses that are native that have some bare ground aspect, because the bobwhite like to run on the ground and flee that way. But if you have a bunch of carpet grass, they're sitting on top of that, they don't like that. And there's usually a lot less insects in those non-native grass pastures for them to eat, less seeds, less insects, less food. So they don't like to sit up top on that grass. So if you're catering to a cow-calf operation and you've got coastal Bermuda, you're not going to have bobwhite. And you might call, say, oh, I had one. Well, do you have them there every day? Are they breeding? The answer I can tell you is no. So they're going to be in native grass. And that's really the problem with bobwhite. A lot of people like to blame fire ants as the problem. Well, it's another problem, but it's not the first and the original and the greater problem. As is the non-native grass, and the smaller parcel size is a problem. Bobwhite need lots of numbers, and the only way to get that is with big, giant contiguous grasslands. And we're talking 5,000 acres or greater, depending on the expert you talk to. But I use the smallest number I use is 5,000 acres. So if you've got 50 acres, you're not going to do anything for quail. Sorry. If your neighbor has 50, they're not going to be able to help. So you've got to get enough neighbors around you to amass 5,000 acres minimum to really do something for quail. You've got to get native grasses back in. Those native grasses are going to be encouraged by frequent fire, prescribed fire. Yes, fire is part of the system here, and that's another problem with quail is fire suppression. So there are a lot of things going against the quail, and they have been almost wiped out from this part of Louisiana and where I'm in East Texas. They're just, it's a rarity. I get more excited when I see a quail than I would a bald eagle. It's just that unusual to have a bobwhite. So,
and is that because a lot of these European grasses really are, are we talking St. Augustine, centipede, ryegrass,
no,
the kind of lawn grasses?
Those are different. It's a similar concept, but they are they're different. They're mostly going to be like coastal Bermuda, fescue, winter rye. There's a whole bunch of species that and really coastal Bermuda is going to be the dominant one, and that's the one you see out in rural lands that cattle feed from.
Mm-hmm.
And so that they just have this carpet grass appearance where they don't allow any bare ground. They just take over from wall to wall, from edge to edge. And that's what bobwhite don't like. They don't like that. They need more of the bunch grasses with some forbs and a variety of plants. And those native grasslands actually work better with our climate. You don't have to constantly pump in nitrogen and fertilizer, and you don't have to ship it in, you know, and go get it in the truck. So it's very expensive to maintain coastal Bermuda mm-hmm. pastures, but if your objective is to fatten up the cows, it does work. But if your objective is to bring Bob White back, it will not work.
Okay. You are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. He is also the non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. He's here to take your calls tonight. We're also trying to take some pledges, and we've got a couple of online pledges. One from Volya Minich, I'm not sure if I pronounce that correctly, from Nacogdoches, Texas. Thank you very much. She enjoys science programs like What's Bugging You, Bird Calls, and Health Matters. And also from another one from Nacogdoches, Texas. And this was Kathy Griffin. Thank you very much for your renewing membership. Both of those renewing memberships. We appreciate that. And we encourage you to call in right now with a question or a pledge or both. And that would be sweet. Both is always good at 800-552-8502. As right now, we are out of questions other than the ones I have lined up for you. So we're going to go to Bill next, and that's me. And again, when I set that recorder out in the backyard, I gathered. Now, again, my ears says different birds throughout the 8 minutes of file. And so I tried to isolate out a couple of different segments that I thought they were clearly different. And here's another segment, and I'm not sure what I was hearing okay. here, but it seemed clearly different to me.
Yeah, those are all house sparrows.
Okay.
And they're two different calls. There's a chattering individual and the chirping individual, but they're all the same. It tells me that there's probably three, four, or more house sparrows there. And again, these are non-native. We talked about that earlier with the nest boxes with the purple martin and bluebird boxes. So the house sparrow and the starling we mentioned, those two birds were brought into the U.S. from Europe and Asia as for several reasons. One is, you know, when people came and settled this land, they wanted creature comforts from home. And they wanted, you know, the flowers that they grew up with and the bird songs that they grew up with. And so they brought them. And also, in the name of insect control, they thought these would control insects, but they didn't, and they've just actually done probably more harm, especially the starling, which I mentioned earlier, usurping woodpeckers. It's done more harm than good.
And also waking me up at 5 in the morning.
That's not good.
As much as I'm an animal lover, I don't want to hear the baby crying at 5 a.m. in the morning, especially when it's not my baby.
It's tough for you to feed them too, isn't it?
Well, especially when they're up in the roof. That was, and I did call my apartment managers, and they were like, "We don't know what to do," but apparently they did something because a day and a half later it stopped. Now, either the birds fledged.
They probably fledged. You played sounded like big nestlings that were probably ready. I don't remember how many days a starling needs in a nest. It's not very long, 12 to 14 days probably. So that could have been, you know, 13, 14-day-old youngsters.
I could actually hear them walking around. You could in the roofing, so I could hear them. They'd be scratching over here, and then the next thing I know, it sounds like they're in another room. And so they were moving around all through that crawl space in between the floors.
And they're getting big, and they're probably three or four, and they're shoving and pushing for space, and it's probably hot in there. It's probably really uncomfortable.
I would
imagine. That's when you want to be 18 and leave home.
Yes.